Good morning. This is Jane reading to you from the Herald and Review on a very brisk January 21st, 2026. And speaking of cold weather, let's get right into it with a local story headlined "Cold Weather Taxes City Pipes. Decatur Crew Tackles the Likely Water Main Break Near the Courthouse." And you've got pictures of the crew out there in this horrible weather. City of Decatur Water Department employees utilize a vacuum excavator to suction away water after a likely water main break at the intersection of Eastwood Street and South Water Street in Decatur on Tuesday, January 20th. That was yesterday. Quote, "With the weather being so volatile, when it goes up and down, it causes the pipes to expand," said Edison Cole. "Once it starts warming back up, we'll start having some more, with it going to 30 down to 15 degrees. And another short news item from the physical world, if I can say, a 3.8 magnitude earthquake in central Illinois. You may have already heard about that. U.S. Geological Survey officials reported a 3.8 magnitude earthquake happened overnight near Ullman in central Illinois. USGS said the quake happened shortly before 1:30 a.m. about 3 miles northeast of Ullman, which is about 45 miles southeast of Springfield, and was felt in Sangamon and Christian counties. As of Tuesday morning, no injuries had been reported due to the quake. According to the Illinois State Geological Survey, earthquakes occur in Illinois about once every year. The last damaging earthquake happened in downstate Illinois in June 1987. And here's some national news that affects us all, having to do with the Affordable Care Act. There is broad bipartisan support in the House and Senate for reviving the federal health care subsidies that expired at the beginning of the year. But long-time disagreements over abortion coverage threaten to block compromise and leave millions of Americans with higher premiums. Despite significant progress, bipartisan Senate negotiations on the subsidies seem to be near collapse, as the abortion dispute appears intractable. Quote, "Once we get past this issue, there's decent agreement on everything else," Senator Bernie Moreno, a Republican of Ohio, who led the talks, told reporters. Republicans seek stronger curbs on abortion coverage for those who purchase insurance off the marketplaces created by the Affordable Care Act. Democrats strongly oppose such changes, especially in the wake of the Supreme Court overturning of Roe v. Wade in 2022. Advocacy groups on both sides push against compromise that they believe would weaken their positions. The impasse was a familiar obstacle for lawmakers who have argued over the health law, known widely as Obamacare, since it was passed 16 years ago. The two sides are passionate about abortion, so I think if they can find a way to bring it up, they probably will, said Yvette Gomez, a senior policy analyst on women's health policy for KFF, the healthcare research nonprofit. The abortion dispute dates back to the weeks and months before President Barack Obama signed the health care overhaul in 2010, when Democrats who controlled Congress added provisions ensuring that federal dollars subsidizing the health plans would not pay for elective abortions. The compromise came after negotiations with members of their own party, whose opposition to abortion rights threatened to sink the legislation. The final language allowed states to offer plans under the Affordable Care Act that cover elective abortions, but said federal money could not pay for them. States are now required to segregate funding for those procedures. Since then, 25 states passed laws prohibiting abortion coverage in the ACA plans. 12 passed laws requiring abortion coverage in the plans, and 13 states and the District of Columbia have no coverage limitations or requirements, according to KFF. Some Republicans and anti-abortion groups now want to make it harder for the states that require or allow the coverage, arguing the segregated funds are nothing more than a gimmick that allows taxpayer dollars to pay for abortions. Senators involved in the negotiations said a potential compromise was to investigate some of those states to ensure they segregate the money correctly. Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, who led the negotiations with Moreno, said, quote, "The answer is to audit those states and enforce the law if they are not properly segregating their funds." Still, that plan was unlikely to win unanimity from Republicans, and Democrats have not signed on. Negotiators were more optimistic last week after President Donald Trump told House Republicans at a meeting that, quote, "You have to be a little flexible on rules that federal dollars can't be used for abortions." Those words from the president came just before a House vote on Democratic legislation that would extend the ACA tax credits for 3 years. After his comments, 17 Republicans voted with Democrats on the extension over the objections of GOP leadership, and the House passed the bill with no new abortion restrictions. Anti-abortion groups reacted swiftly. Kelsey Pritchard, a spokeswoman for Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America, said the group would not support the 17 Republicans who voted for the extension. Trump's comments were, quote, "a complete change in position for him that brought a lot of backlash and outcry from the anti-abortion movement and voters opposed to abortion rights," she said. Those who did not support changes to the ACA to reduce abortion coverage, quote, "are going to pay the price in the midterms this year," Pritchard said. "We are communicating to them that this isn't acceptable." Democrats, who say the Republican effort to amend the law and increase restrictions on abortion is a distraction, focus on extending COVID-era subsidies that expired January 1st and kept costs down for millions of Americans in the United States. The average subsidized enrollee faces more than double the monthly premium costs for 2026, according to KFF. The two sides have haggled since the fall, when Democrats voted to shut down the government for 43 days as they demanded negotiations on extending the subsidies. Republicans refused to negotiate until a small group of moderate Democrats agreed to vote with them and end the shutdown. After the shutdown ended, Republicans made clear that they would not budge on the subsidies without changes on abortion, and the Senate rejected a 3-year extension of tax credits. Maine Senator Angus King, an independent who caucuses with Democrats, said making it harder to cover abortion was a red line for Democrats, and Republicans are going to own these increases in premiums, he said. The bipartisan group that met in recent weeks closed in on parts of an agreement, including a 2-year deal that would extend the enhanced subsidy while adding new limits and creating the option in the second year of a health savings account that Trump and Republicans prefer. The ACA open enrollment period would be extended to March 1st of this year to allow people more time to figure out their coverage plans after the interruption of the enhanced subsidy. However, the abortion issue continues to stand in the way of a deal. And since we're on the subject of health, you may have heard that the new food pyramid has been published. The 2025-2030 Dietary Guidelines for Americans have been announced, and there are some surprises. What has changed in these updated recommendations for how Americans should eat? For one, the previous document from 5 years ago was a whopping 164 pages. Our current document has been simplified to a mere 10 pages. Another big change, the food pyramid, which was retired in 2011 in favor of the more practical My Plate icon, has made an interesting comeback, and it literally has been turned on its head. Foods of highest priority in this newest recommended eating plan include high-quality proteins from both animal and plant sources, a variety of colorful fruits and vegetables, dairy foods, healthy fats, and whole grains. There are enhanced warnings to limit our intake of highly processed foods, added sugars, and refined carbohydrates. What's the basis for these guidelines? The process is the same every 5 years. First, two government departments, Health and Human Services and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, convene a special committee of nutrition and health experts from around the country. Their job? To review the most recent scientific research in the field of nutrition and health, and then produce a report on which the guidelines for healthful eating can be based. This 421-page report was published in 2025, and from it has come the current 2020-2025 dietary guidelines for Americans. Parts of these new guidelines have already become controversial. Why is that? The science of nutrition has many variables, and the interpretation of research studies is not always clear-cut. For example, some new evidence has shown that full-fat dairy foods may not affect the risk for heart disease any different than low-fat versions of dairy foods. These updated guidelines include both forms as part of a healthful eating pattern. Yet, if you look closely, the recommendation for us to limit our intake of saturated fats to not more than 10% of our total daily calories has not changed from the previous guidelines. One way to meet this goal, according to the newest report, is to cut back on highly processed foods that often contain excess amounts of saturated fats. Perhaps the biggest message in the latest guideline is for us to focus on real food, that which is as close to possible as it to its original form. That includes fresh produce, poultry, eggs, fish, meat, and dairy foods. Yes, more high-quality research is still needed to answer many unanswered questions about our diet and health, yet the goal, to shift our food system away from chronic disease and toward nutrient density, nourishment, resilience, and long-term health, is still admirable. Let's see how we do. Now, three obituary notices. Let's start with James Lee Frieden, Sr. of Blue Mound, Illinois, who died on January 15th, 2026, in Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana, Illinois. The family will receive friends on Friday, January 23rd, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Moran and Goebel Funeral Home. Funeral service will be at 10 a.m. on Saturday, January 24th, in the funeral home. Burial will be in South Macon Township Cemetery, Macon, Illinois. Memorials may be made to the National Wild Turkey Federation. Then, Natalie Ann Barrow, born on November 6, 1939 in Warba, Minnesota, passed away on January 15, 2026 in Eldon, Missouri. A celebration of Natalie's life will be held at the Eagles Club in Grand Rapids, Minnesota on February 7th from 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. Then Daniel F. Seal of Weldon, Illinois. He passed away on January 16th, 2026 at his family residence in Weldon, Illinois. Arrangements are still incomplete at Calvert Funeral Home in Clinton, Illinois. And finally, Donald K. Hyland. Don Hyland, 92 years old, of Decatur, formerly of Mount Zion, passed away on Sunday, January 18th, 2026. The family will receive friends on Wednesday, January 21st, that's today, from 10 a.m. to the service time of 11 a.m. at Moran and Goebel Funeral Home. The burial will be at Mount Zion Township Cemetery, Mount Zion, Illinois. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Mount Zion Library or the Mount Zion Presbyterian Church. Because we were talking about the food pyramid, here's a rather interesting note. The headline, Sober Sips, Non-Alcoholic Options Are Making Dry January a Bit More Beerable. At the start of 2025, a study by the Beer Institute revealed that 60% of Americans saw non-alcoholic beer as a viable alternative for long-term moderation. But what about just for 1 month? For many, Dry January is in full swing, though people do it for different reasons. Some see the 31 days as a dependency test to determine just how reliant they are on alcohol to relax. Others link it to their overall New Year health and/or weight loss plans. Some participants view it as a reset following the weeks of decadent holiday consumption, and others might be dipping a toe into the idea of permanent sobriety without drawing too much attention from their peer group. The truth is, drinking overall, that's all 12 months, is down. According to an August 2025 Gallup poll, Americans' alcohol consumption is at record lows. Gallup has tracked the nation's drinking behaviors since 1939. More options are on offer at bars. In speaking with hospitality professionals in Orlando, Florida, that tracks. And though many pin it mostly on the reduced alcohol habits of Gen Z, their interest in fewer or other intoxicants, primarily marijuana, now recreationally legal in nearly half the country, isn't the fuel firing the growth segment for non-alcoholic beer. I think there are a number of reasons why it's more popular, says Jason Campbell, chief executive chef of Team Market Group, who, alongside colleague Nick Greco, oversees 10 venues in Florida. Medical marijuana's growing in use, but I also think people are being a little more responsible, he says. Non-alcoholic beer is on most of the Team Market Group menus, he says, though there's a bit more interest in places like Primrose Lanes, where bowling and burgers make beer a popular third B, and Nuri's Tavern, where tavern pizza and beer go hand in hand. During Dry January, that goes up, says Campbell, whose brands on offer include Stella Artois and Heineken, both zero alcohol. Bartender Big Rick at the Vineyard Wine Company in Lake Mary, Florida, says it stocks several non-alcoholic options, and they've steadily grown in popularity. I purchased O'Doul's, Michelob Ultra Zero, Peroni, Nastro Azzurro, all 0%, with regularity, he says. Sometimes, he notes, people drinking regular beer will switch over in the course of one evening. We have people who want to enjoy themselves, but not take it overboard. They'll drink a Mexican lager that we carry, and then move over to a non-alcoholic beer so that way they can hang out at the bar a little while longer, snack with their friends, enjoy a good night out, and, importantly, be able to drive back home safely. Not all non-alcoholic beer is zero alcohol, and that can be confusing. U.S. regulations allow up to 0.5% alcohol by volume to use the non-alcoholic designation. Those with lower percentages will note it on labels and cans. As Rick suggests, lagers like Corona do a fine job of mimicking the crisp, light body of the real thing. A wedge of lime on the bottle completes the picture. And there's psychology involved, say the pros, that helps Dry January participants feel like it's just a regular night out. I think that's why brands like Liquid Death, canned water, really took off. You can grab a can, drink it like it's nothing, and people don't think anything about it. Last year, during my own dry January run, I'll admit that holding the bottle made a difference. I tried several non-alcoholic beers, including Stella Artois, Heineken, Bitburger, and others. My favorite of the lot was Samuel Adams' Just the Haze IPA, the ABV of which clocks in at under 0.5%. Recently, though, I dabbled in the wares of Athletic Brewing Company, which has an entire line range of flavors from autumn browns to tropical sours, all below 0.5%. They're fantastic products, Rick says. They even do cocktail-inspired brews. Paloma and Moscow Mule are among them. My foray into Athletic's Run Wild IPA will have me searching for others to sample as the month moves on, just in case I find myself craving the normalcy of happy hour. One hospitality pro, a hotel bartender, noted a recent moment during a convention when a patron asked her to pour a non-alcoholic beer into a glass for him. He still wanted to hang out and network, but didn't want to drink anymore. Without the label, he blended in. Campbell says there's a lot to that, and he's happy his and other places can offer it. It's a safe haven, he says, because sobriety is a thing even if it's not dry January. Abstention is a challenge for a lot of people, and non-alcoholic beer could be a stepping stone toward larger sobriety. And here's one more public health story of interest. Overdose deaths dip. Researchers propose theories for decrease that followed the pandemic. Overdose deaths fell through most of last year in the United States, suggesting a lasting improvement in a crisis that worsened for decades. Federal data released this month showed overdose deaths fell for more than 2 years, the longest drop in decades, but also that the decline slowed. The monthly death toll is still not back to where it was before the COVID-19 pandemic, let alone where it was before the current overdose crisis struck decades ago, said Brandon Marshall, a Brown University researcher who studies overdose trends. Overall, I think this continues to be encouraging, he said, especially since we're seeing declines almost across the nation. Overdose deaths started to steadily climb in the 1990s with overdoses involving opioid painkillers, followed by waves of deaths from heroin, and more recently, illicit fentanyl. Deaths peaked at almost 110,000 in 2022, fell a little in 2023, and then plummeted 27% in 2024 to about 80,000. That was the largest one-year decline ever recorded. The new Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data runs through August 2025 and represents the first update of monthly provisional drug overdose deaths since the federal government shutdown. An estimated 73,000 people died from overdoses in the 12-month period that ended August 2025, down about 21% from the 92,000 in the prior 12-month period. CDC officials reported that deaths were down in all states except Arizona, Hawaii, Kansas, New Mexico, and North Dakota. However, they noted it's likely that not all overdose deaths were reported yet in every state, and future data might affect that state count. Researchers can't say yet with confidence why deaths went down. Experts offered possible explanations. Increased availability of overdose-reversing drug naloxone, expanded addiction treatment, shifts in how people use drugs, and the growing impact of billions of dollars in opioid lawsuit settlement money. Some also point to research that suggests the number of people likely to overdose shrank as fewer teens took up drugs and many illicit drug users died. Two other theories have recently emerged. In a recent paper published in the journal Science, University of Maryland researchers point to the drug supply. They say regulatory changes in China a few years ago appear to have diminished the availability of precursor chemicals used to make fentanyl. Their argument is based partly on information from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, which last year reported the purity and dangerous potency of fentanyl rose in the COVID-19 pandemic but fell after 2022. That suggests it became harder to make fentanyl and its potency was diluted. One piece of evidence: more U.S.-based Reddit users reported a fentanyl drought in 2023. The authors connect that to signs that the Chinese government, at the U.S. officials' urging, took steps in 2023 to clamp down on the selling of substances used to make drugs. Information is limited on exactly what the Chinese government did, but the paper is a bit speculative. We thought we could make a case, said Peter Reuter, one of the authors. The recent deceleration of overdose deaths could be because producers in Canada and Mexico found alternative sources, Reuter and his colleague think. Their paper drew inspiration from a team of University of Pittsburgh researchers who concluded that regulatory changes in China concerning the drug carfentanil were an important explanation for a dip in U.S. overdose deaths in 2018. Did payments play a role? Those Pittsburgh researchers, Dr. Donald Burke and Dr. Jalal, now focus on another theory. In a paper published this month in the International Journal of Drug Policy, they say overdose trends may be at least partly tied to federal stimulus checks sent out during the COVID-19 pandemic. The researchers tracked three rounds of such payments to U.S. households in 2020 and 2021 and saw surges in overdose deaths after each one. That money alleviated economic hardship for many families, but some of it also helped people pay for illicit drugs, the Pittsburgh researchers say. The end of those payments helps explain why overdoses stabilized in 2022 and fell afterward. Both arguments seem to have merit, but they do not prove causation, said Dr. Daniel Ciccarone, a drug policy expert at the University of California, San Francisco. I personally think it's more complicated, with those partial explanations layering on other trends. Researchers also raise questions about whether the Trump administration policies, including strained relations with China, canceled grants, and promised checks, could slow the momentum.